under advisement. Next is in the matter of the registrants HD and JM. If counsel could step forward, please. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Frank Jujuko, Assistant Prosecutor, Essex County, on behalf of the state and HD.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. David Galeva, Assistant Salem County Prosecutor, on behalf of the state and the matter of JM.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Emily R. Anderson, Deputy Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Attorney General and JM.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Fletcher Duddy, Deputy Public Defender, appearing on behalf of the respondent HD.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Jesse Ross from the Public Defender's Office on behalf of the registrant.
And Alexander Shalom from the Office of Liberty Team in New Jersey as the president of the court.
Good afternoon and welcome, counsel. We're optimistic that counsel have coordinated their presentations because there will be a fair amount of overlap. Mr. Ducote, please go ahead.
Before I begin, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Thank you. May it please the court. There's a few things we hear all the time in Megan's Law cases, and I think they bear repeating in this one. Megan's Law is a legitimate civil regulatory registration scheme that permits law enforcement to identify and alert the public when necessary for public safety. Once a person is convicted of a qualifying sex offense and put on Megan's Law, it is presumptively for life. That is the rule. It is also the rule that termination conditions are a matter for the legislature, not the courts. Now, there is a very narrow exception, and that's what this case is all about. And this case is one of statutory interpretation. So I want to look right at the statute we're talking about, which is subsection F. A person can be relieved of their Megan's Law obligations if they meet a two-prong test. Only the first prong is relevant here. And that language is, the person has not committed an offense within 15 years following conviction or release from a correctional facility or any term of imprisonment imposed, whichever is later. That language unquestionably refers to when Megan's Law obligations begin. Even the appellate division recognized this at page 9 of their opinion. There is no ambiguity as to when the 15-year clock starts. And 15 years is, as this court has said, a fair measure by which to judge the risk of reoffense. There is simply no fair measure if the 15-year period starts and stops with each new conviction. That should have been the end of the analysis. Now, to accept the appellate division and the registrant's position would require this court to find, in the language I just read, some mechanism that allows the clock to be restarted each and every time a registrant commits a new offense. That's not in the statute, but that's their whole argument, that the statute allows for a restarting, and the 15 years that matter aren't the ones, quote, following conviction or release, even though that's exactly what the statute says, but 15 years since the last conviction. Now, if the legislature wanted that to be the rule, that's what they would have said, since the last conviction. And we know that they know how to use that language because they use that language in the PSL statute. Now, the appellate division called this verbiage, and they said, let's just harmonize the two because they're similar. But this violates a long-accepted rule that where the legislature chooses in one place to use a term and not another, it should not be implied where excluded. But courts have no business harmonizing that which the legislature intentionally made discordant. The legislature is no stranger to line drawing. The 18-year-old that turns 18 on the day after Election Day can't vote. The person who commits a crime on their 18th birthday gets prosecuted as an adult. The trial witness who had a conviction 9 years and 364 days earlier, that conviction gets used to impeach them. In all of these situations, someone can say that the line was drawn unfairly. But the legislature draws lines, not courts. And this court has said 15 years is a fair measurement. If you can't stay offense-free, you aren't entitled to the benefit. There is no fair measurement if the registrant can restart the clock with each new criminal offense. And that's my opening, and I welcome the court's questions.
So HD claims that until recently, the statute was widely read to allow for the clock to be reset. Is that accurate?
Not accurate.
Tell us your understanding of what's happened in practice, and to the extent you can go beyond Essex, please.
Certainly. Before this case came to light, the majority of counties were interpreting it the way we were. There were a few that were not. When the issue was brought, because there was never any litigation, guidance, anything on this issue before. Once it came to light, and I know the Attorney General can speak on this more, The Attorney General advised the counties that that is their reading of the statute, and that's how it should be advocated.
Do you know how many counties were following a different approach?
I don't know. I know it was a small minority. I don't think it was more than five. I think they would provide better numbers, but it was not certainly unanimous going one way or the other. And I'll just say that even if some counties were interpreting it wrong, certainly that doesn't guide the court. I mean, we often interpret things wrong until the court comes along and tells us we're doing it wrong, and then we fix it.
So let's go to the plain language that you rely heavily on. Does it expressly say you can't reset the clock looking just at F?
No, but it doesn't say you can't either. And it makes very clear that the 15 years is following the conviction or release that puts the person on Megan's Law, a person required to register under this act. Megan's Law is triggered when there's a conviction and no jail, or when the person gets out of jail, which makes sense because you don't have to register while you're in state prison.
If the law neither says that it can be reset or cannot be reset, doesn't that undermine your argument about plain language?
No, because the language is what we say it is. They're the ones looking to add something to it. We're saying it starts in 15 years, and if you did commit an offense within 15 years, you're out. And if you have not committed an offense within 15 years, you are. To say that the clock somehow restarts without the legislature specifically saying it restarts, or using different language that would suggest it refers to some other more recent offense, writes something into the statute that isn't there. And if we look at the PSL statute, we know that the legislature there said any crime, not offense, since the last conviction, which means there could be additional convictions, and we look back to that one. So without that language in the Megan's Law statute, I think they would have to say something like that, and the fact that they didn't says a lot.
You make a strong argument that there's different language in the PSL, CSL statute. What's the principled reason for a difference between these two statutes, as you've argued?
Because PSL, and before that CSL, was punitive. It's penal. It's part of the sentence. It makes sense that the legislature might have made it a little easier for those people to get off of CSL, especially knowing that they'd probably still be registering. Registration is far less onerous than conditions of PSL.
Isn't it more than that, though, Mr. Decote? PSL was adding a new penalty that was going to be imposed on people as they were being sentenced. With Megan's Law, the legislature was looking back in time to impose the Megan's Law registration requirement on people who had already been convicted in the past and may have been walking free, may have been in another state coming into New Jersey, or were about to be released. And when you look at the section that you're focusing on, F, it's tying the time to when the person is required to register, which earlier in 7-2 picks up all of those different points in time. For example, C4 talks about when a person is required to register on the effective date who's not confined on the effect. You have 120 days from being released. Everything in F is being tied to at what point in time the person is first subjected to the registration requirement.
Correct.
And that's why your argument has a textual attraction, because it is focused on the conviction that is compelling the person to have to register, and then the timing of that registration as a result of it. It's not a free-floating time period as to when the person is first put on CSL or then PSL, which can happen at any point into the future.
Right, and their position would have this court read the word offense and the word conviction as F as being the same event. It doesn't make a lot of sense. The legislature couldn't have meant
the language is very different.
Correct.
So you started answering earlier, and I thought you were about to say one statute is punitive and one is remedial.
Correct.
So tell us how Section F is remedial in the case of a minor offense that is committed.
Because it's remedial because it makes sense for the legislature to have said, if you can't go 15 years without committing an offense after your first offense, the offense that put you on Megan's Law, you're more likely to reoffend than someone who doesn't.
So let's say
commit an offense within those 15.
No matter the nature of the offense.
Right.
So let's take that. So someone steals a candy bar, okay, within the first year, under your interpretation, lifetime bar, correct?
Correct.
If the person steals the candy bar in the 16th year, the person can apply and get off registration because he was 15 years offense free, correct?
Yes, because that's exactly what the legislature decided.
I'm just
that's not my
you.
Position, that's the statute's
okay.
position.
So the other question I wanted to ask you was this. Is the only issue before us statutory interpretation?
We're
not being asked to determine whether or not some particular set of facts might offend the due process clause.
You are not. No.
No due process issue.
No. So the only issue is what is the meaning of the statute? Zero, and that's it.
Right. And it has always been our position since day one that this offense knocks HD out of the box because that offense was committed within 15 years. But again, nothing I'm arguing would stop. You know, I'm sure you're going to hear some interesting hypothetical registrants that it may seem unfair to apply it that way. But nothing would stop them from bringing an as-applied challenge if the state's conduct in putting them on Megan's moves the needle from civil to punitive. That's always a possibility.
I know that you've said that CSL is punitive, but earlier, when the nature of CSL was being debated, didn't the state take the position that it wasn't a penalty, it wasn't punitive? Am I mistaken in previous cases going back?
I mean, somebody may have taken that, but we now know that that's wrong.
I understand. So when going back to the legislature, what the legislature intended when it enacted it, if it had the same mind as the state when it was arguing some of these previous cases, maybe they didn't think it was punitive, even though this court later determined, given a constitutional analysis, it was punitive.
Well, I mean,
you following me?
I am, and to be fair, I mean, I won't speak on positions previously taken before cases were decided, but I think, at least now, the way the PSL statute is structured and the conditions that are on it, I don't think a credible argument can be made anymore that it's not penal. I mean, so, and I'm not making that argument here.
Anyone have questions? Anything you'd like to add, Mr. DeCote?
Not at this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Glenbo.
May it please the court. In drafting Megan's Law, the legislature determined that the relative recidivism rate of sex offenders is high compared to other offenders for a particularly egregious type of offense that threatens the most vulnerable people in society. But in requiring presumptive lifetime registration, the legislature gave registrants an exit ramp, provided that they could meet the two criteria laid out in subsection F. The second criterion, that the registrant is not likely to pose a threat to the safety of others, is a judgment decision made by a court. The first criterion, that the registrant has not committed an offense within 15 years following conviction or release, is a concrete measure of whether individuals who committed offenses subjecting them to Megan's Law are able to comply with the rules of society. Consistent with the statute's plain language and the law's purpose to protect the public from sex offenders, it is the 15-year window from imposition of Megan's Law registration requirements that the legislature used to measure the offense-free period. Foremost, the plain language dictates the state's reading of the pertinent phrase and should end the inquiry. Context matters when interpreting statutes. The registrant's interpretation of conviction, accepted by the appellate division, strips it from its context within the particular subsection, the statute 2C7-2, and the Megan's Law scheme as a whole. But common sense does not get checked at the door when deciding what the legislature meant with their word choice. The conviction and release referenced in subsection F clearly tracks back to the originating sex conviction as defined earlier in the statute. 2C72 paragraph A immediately sets out who the act applies to, a person who has been convicted for commission of a sex offense. Subsection B then sets out the predicate sex offenses that subject a person to registration. Read in conjunction with paragraph F, which again reminds us that it applies to a person required to register under this act, it is clear that conviction or release referenced is for the sex offense on which the entire legislative scheme is based. In JS, the appellate division actually interpreted conviction to refer to the entry of the judgment of conviction, because that's when Megan's Law registration requirements are imposed at the time of sentencing. If the 15-year clock starts at the time the registration requirements are imposed, it cannot also serve as a starting point for some hypothetical future offense. The only way to accomplish this would be to add language, but the courts cannot imply terms where the legislature excluded them. As Mr. Dakota already referred to, if the legislature wanted to make a resetting clock, it certainly knew how to accomplish this. It did that with the CSL termination provision. Also, with regard to the CSL termination provision, not only does it provide that it's from the last conviction or release, it also provides that the offender has not committed a crime for 15 years. Four denotes an indefinite 15-year block that can run from the last conviction, whereas subsection F, on the other hand, provides that the person has not committed an offense within 15 years following conviction. Within and following denote a finite time frame measured from the conviction that the entire statute addresses, the underlying sexual conviction that triggered registration. While the language is clear, if this court harbors any doubt, it should be resolved in favor of the clear legislative intent set out in 2C7-1 to enable communities to protect themselves from sex offenders and to aid law enforcement in apprehending them. The more registration, the more knowledge of sex offenders' presence, which is the key to the law's effect. Subsection F should not be interpreted in a way that would give sex offenders multiple bites at the apple for a law that's designed to protect the public. And under the registrant's interpretation, sex offenders could repeatedly flout the law, incurring new offense after new offense after the conviction or release. That, the state would submit, is an absurd result. Registration requirements are presumptively lifetime requirements, and its provisions should be interpreted consistently with that presumption. Termination is conditional relief, contingent upon the registrant's own conduct, but the registrant does not get to control the 15-year offense-free period by their own future criminality. 15 years of registration compliance is the yardstick. And if a registrant who's already on Megan's Law by virtue of a conviction for a serious sexual offense cannot be offense-free for this period, they are disqualified from this narrow exception. If your honors have any questions, that concludes my opening.
Well, if there is doubt, wouldn't we apply the doctrine of constitutional doubt? I've given the hypothetical of a candy bar being stolen within the first year. I take it you wouldn't argue that if that offense occurred, that the person, that offense would heighten the person's danger as a sexual offender for the rest of his life?
The fact that the person could not go 15 years, when this person is under essentially a microscope during those 15 years, they know and are repeatedly reminded.
So I understand that, but so now it's a remedial statute. The question is, at what point does it cross the threshold into a penal statute? And that threshold typically is passed when the statute no longer has any rehabilitative purpose, and when the person no longer poses any danger whatsoever to society. Would you agree that is where the threshold is crossed?
I would agree, but I don't think a court could conclude that person has no risk. The standard, even under that,
I'm not saying, well, not this court, but a court at some point later. So, a $1 candy bar is stolen in the first year, and 20 years later the person wants to apply for removal from registration. And your position would be no can do. Can't do that because that's what the statute is. Would you argue that the statute under those circumstances is remedial or penal?
It's still remedial at that point because, first of all, I don't believe
it. Weren't you going to say, isn't the issue there not whether it was a candy bar or something more, but the fact that the person couldn't stay away from committing a crime?
That's correct. We should expect anybody to follow basic rules of society. And this is somebody, they're not on Megan's Law for stealing a candy bar. They're they've already violated the law in a very serious way. So knowing that they can go those 15 years and apply to get released and they still can't refrain from committing an antisocial act, yes, that they are more of a risk than somebody who can go those 15 years.
So person 18 years old commits the candy bar offense, and now he's 50 years old. Still can't trust him, offense free, nothing. You're telling me the statute is still serving a remedial purpose when he's 30 years later, 50 years old?
Your Honor, as Mr. DeCote was stating in his argument, the registrant at that point can always make an as-applied challenge to himself. There would have to be a robust record on how that is no longer serving a public safety interest. That's not one of these cases that's before this court. So I don't mean to state that threshold could never be crossed, but that's not in front of this court.
I think the argument that Justice Alvin's trying to make to you is that if the legislature decided to give a window of time once someone goes onto a registration requirement, and it is just a registration requirement, it's not parole, so we're keeping it away from PSL, and they decided they were going to allow the first 15 years as the time period for that individual to prove that he or she could abide by all the rules that would be imposed on them as a condition of that registration, plus avoiding any criminal activity, then they can get off of the registration requirement. But if they didn't extend that, somehow that makes it punitive. My question to you is, if the legislature decided to give that one 15-year period, and that's it for allowing someone to be freed from an ongoing registration requirement, does that change it from being a remedial registration requirement into something that becomes punitive? I think that's the essence of what he's asking you. And up to this point in time, we haven't said that that's true, have we?
I think in Doe versus Ports, it was assumed that these were lifetime
registration requirements.
Mm-hmm. So if they are being given a chance, everybody has that same chance to go 15 years. It's basically, there's two parts to this test, and to even qualify under the second part of the test, you have to go those 15 years.
So in your view, does the legislation have to fail if the legislature has chosen not to continually reopen that window of opportunity to get off?
Absolutely not.
There really was no constitutional requirement that it give any 15-year period at all, was there?
No.
So the fact that they gave the 15-year period, it doesn't become unconstitutional because it's not longer.
Correct.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Anderson.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The question before this Court today is, should a sex offender be offered another opportunity to terminate his or her registration obligations under Megan's Law after failing to remain offense-free within 15 years following the conviction that triggered the Megan's Law obligations? The Attorney General's answer to this question, supported by both the plain language of subsection F and public policy considerations, is no. There should be no second bite of the apple. This Court should rule that a registrant who commits a sex offense within 15 years, measured from the date of conviction that triggered the Megan's Law obligations, or release from the prison term imposed as a result of that conviction, cannot thereafter successfully seek to terminate from registering under Megan's Law. Both the plain language of subsection F and public policy considerations support this interpretation. First, the phrase conviction or release must be read in conjunction with the first part of subsection F, which specifically ties the rest of the subsection to the underlying sex offense by focusing it on those offenders required to register under this act. Therefore, the offense-free period in question is tied to the underlying sex offense that triggered the offender's registration obligations under Megan's Law. And the clock on that 15-year time frame does not reset. If the legislature had intended the registrant's interpretation of subsection F to be law, it would have written subsection F differently. Indeed, the difference between the CSL-PSL statute and subsection F of Megan's Law is particularly instructive because they were passed on the same day as part of a comprehensive legislative package meant to protect the public from sex offenders after the tragic rape and death of Megan Kanka. In the CSL statute, the legislature specifically allowed for an offender to apply for termination if they had not committed a crime for 15 years since the last conviction or release from incarceration. This makes it abundantly clear that the legislature intended the clock to reset for CSL-PSL, giving offenders the opportunity to get to terminate from CSL-PSL after 15 years of good behavior, provided they do not pose a continuing threat to the safety of others. But the legislature chose different language for subsection F, which it passed the same day as the CSL-PSL statute. The legislature explicitly omitted the qualifier last from the term conviction and required that a registrant not commit an offense within 15 years following the date of the conviction for the sex offense. These key differences between the two statutes clearly demonstrate the legislature's intent that a sex offender needs to remain offense-free for 15 years following conviction for or release from incarceration due to the sex offense that triggered the Megan's Law obligations, and that the clock for this time period does not reset. This interpretation is sound policy as well. The entire purpose of Megan's Law, actually written into the statute, is to protect the public from sex crimes by giving law enforcement and sometimes the public information regarding sex offenders who are statistically more likely to reoffend. This court has, time and again, affirmed the principle that Megan's Law is a non-punitive scheme and is meant to protect the public. It makes sense that the legislature intended it to be more difficult to terminate from Megan's Law than CSL-PSL because CSL-PSL is part of an offender's sentence. Under CSL-PSL, a sex offender must follow numerous conditions and is subject to monitoring. Megan's Law, however, does not restrict where an offender lives or works. It does not restrict an offender's access to the internet. Rather, it requires an offender to register once a year or every 90 days and update law enforcement with his or her information when it changes. Given that registration under Megan's Law is not punitive, protects the public, and does not present an undue burden to registrant, it makes sense that the legislature intended it to be more difficult to be removed from Megan's Law than CSL-PSL. For the foregoing reasons, this court should rule that subsection F allows a registrant to terminate from Megan's Law only if he or she remains offense-free for 15 years following the conviction or release from incarceration from the sex offense that triggered the offender's registration obligations to begin with, and that this time frame does not reset. This not only comports with the plain language of subsection F, but prevents offenders who cannot remain offense-free for that time period from obtaining a windfall benefit.
I understand your plain language argument. The policy argument that you've advanced, is there anything that supports the argument you've made that section F, in the case of a truly minor offense, take Justice Alvin's candy bar hypothetical, that it is statistically more likely for the candy bar thief to reoffend and commit a Megan's Law offense? Is there anything that supports that at all?
While actually statistics do support that conditions, not being able to follow conditions of release, in other words, again, remaining offense-free for 15 years does increase the likelihood of reoffense, but again, this is...
Are there studies that are key to minimal offenses?
I'm not aware of specific studies regarding minimal offenses, Your Honor, but I will just come back to, again, the plain language of the statute. This is the line that the legislature has chosen. As the state has made abundantly clear and argued, and as this court well knows, The legislature makes these lines all the time. If you are charged with a crime the day before the statute of limitations runs, that is the line the legislature has chosen to draw.
So let's stay with the policy argument. Unless if I understood you correctly, you're suggesting there's no need for the court to base its opinion on that. Because I don't hear support for it, quite frankly, and that's why I've asked.
The general policy, which is, again, the AG's position is that the plain language settles this issue, and we don't need to look farther than that. But it's just the public policy is that it should, for the differences between CSL, PSL, and Megan's Law, it makes sense that it would be easier for somebody to terminate from CSL, PSL, which imposes more restrictions, which is a punitive part of the registrant's sentence, and therefore it makes sense that.
Well, didn't the court get into this with Doe v. Poritz? That was an equal protection challenge. And one of the things that the court had to grapple with was the fact that the legislature acted rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have necessarily statistical information on hand, but under a rational basis test, the legislature is entitled to act on the basis of what it rationally believes without statistical information and draw lines without violating a rational basis requirement. And they did that here. That was implicit in the equal protection holding that the court issued in Doe, was it not?
I would agree with Your Honor. And I would also just add that these are obviously two separate standards. And so the difference has to mean something.
Right.
And so they cannot have used different words on a law that they passed on the same day as part of the same package intending CSL, PSL.
Rational basis goes so far that our court has said that the legislature doesn't even have to have thought of the reason as long as reasons can be developed and presented and considered fair later. That is sufficient for passing rational basis. Is not,
I would,
not correct?
I would agree with Your Honor's statement, and I would also just say in terms of constitutional challenges, again, the court doesn't need to go that far in this case. Certainly.
That's not the issue before us. Someone could make an applied challenge.
Exactly,
Like the legislature could draw lines, but that doesn't mean that there may not be a line so far that it might not offend the Constitution.
And certainly there are extreme examples that can be thought of. However, the court's determination this today is how does this statute apply and how should it be applied and be interpreted generally. And
we are only dealing with an issue of statutory interpretation in this appeal.
Exactly.
Is that
And those exceptions, Justice Alvin, that you mentioned, should not dictate the general rule as to how the statute is interpreted and how the statute is applied.
And if the legislature wants to change the way it operates, it's free to do so.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Chief.
Can you tell us the practice in the state before this issue came to the fore?
The best information that we have, Your Honor, again, we didn't, when I asked in terms of how this has played out in the counties, I did not get a perfect response rate, but I do know that as the state mentioned, I believe the best information we have is that five counties have a differing interpretation, but that more counties view the interpretation the way the state and the Attorney General are. And again, I would reiterate what the state said is that if
that's
all 21
decide cases, but I wanted to know.
Right, right.
And if I may follow up on that, the Chief's question, when you say differing interpretation, just to be clear, five counties have been, I guess, pending advice from the Attorney General, interpreting the statute to have a restart after a conviction that follows the conviction for the sex offense.
Correct.
That generally
I believe the counties are aware of our position in this case and but again, this court's determination in this matter will definitively settle how the statute is to be applied.
Other questions?
Mm-mm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Duddy.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. Moments ago, the Attorney General stated that it's her belief that there are five counties in the state of New Jersey, five out of the 21 counties, which have interpreted subsection F consistent with that of the registrants. I would submit that that's four counties too many at this point to reverse course now. And I would dispute that it is just five counties. In fact, as we speak, but during the pendency of this litigation alone, Camden County, as one example, has been granting these release applications under the same circumstances as that of the registrants here. And so if we were to reverse course now, that would raise all kinds of questions. For one, we would say, do we place everyone back on the registry who was released? We do have proof of this in this case alone, a case from Union County, which is in our appendix. Does that individual go back on the registry?
So let me ask you a question. Are you arguing to the Supreme Court that of several counties have misread the statute, that you, New Jersey Supreme Court, you too now must misread the statute? Forget about interpreting the statute according to plain language. Is that your argument?
That is not the argument. That is not the hill on which I want to die here today, Your Honor. But since the question was asked and answered by the state, I wanted to follow up with that. Because it does beg the question of what do we do now? What to make of the administration of law here? Do they go back on the registry? If not, then that's inequitable. We allow all these registrants to be
but off that, the registry. That's a different issue. The primary issue before is, what does the statute mean? So,
that's
what,
right.
What do you think?
The statute, most certainly, because the word conviction, or better yet, the phrase, conviction or release from a correctional facility for any term of imprisonment imposed, is unqualified, we would submit that it refers to any conviction, as has been the case for the past two decades, and as is still the case in Camden County. What's crucial, though, what is absolutely crucial for Your Honors to understand about the resolution of this case is that the state's position here severely undermines, if not directly conflicts, with Your Honor's opinion in In Re C.K., released less than 2 years ago, where Your Honors held that it would be unconstitutional to require a child to register as a sex offender for the rest of his natural-born life without at least a right of review. That was the core holding in Justice Albin's opinion.
We don't have a constitutional issue before us. We have a statute, and all we're asked to do today is determine what does the statute mean, period. Am I right about that?
You are right, Your Honor, but...
So why are we talking about CK?
I think that... So the court understands where everything fits here. So for the sake of consistency, I have to believe that if your court is going to grant the relief that it did in CK less than 2 years ago, it's not going to remove that very same relief less than 2 years later. But that's precisely what would happen.
We had a constitutional challenge in a juvenile setting. Here we have a statutory challenge. And apparently, you don't want to die on the hill of statutory interpretation because you're raising other things.
No. It's just, like I said, a matter of consistency. CK would be eviscerated if you were to...
CK dealt with a minor, and the issue is particular to a minor, not this case.
And I'm not drawing a line between minors and adults here. I'm simply saying what the state's position would do to your opinion less than 2 years ago.
But that was subsection G. It wasn't even the same subsection.
Right. Well, just consider this, just for the sake of clarity. Okay. So the first clause of subsection G says that one cannot apply for relief if that person was convicted of more than one sex offense. Okay. And so Your Honors held that subsection G, which includes that clause, cannot be applied to children. Okay. We have clients. We have one right now in Passaic County who committed a sex offense, was placed on the registry, shortly thereafter committed another sex offense.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, so forgive me, but you are making a constitutional argument now. There may be a day for that, but this doesn't seem to be the day. Why aren't you arguing to us that this is, look at the statute. It only has one meaning. Why aren't you doing that? The failure to do it,
it is
suggesting that...
The argument was made in our written submissions. Clearly, I'm mistaken, but I wanted to come to court today just to explain to Your Honors, as I said, where everything fits here.
So let's start with, let's turn to the statute.
Right, so the statute.
And specifically, let's turn to the argument that you've heard, that the legislature knows how to use language as contrasted with the CSL-PSL statute, where they talked about last conviction and they didn't use that phraseology here. What does that tell us?
Right, well, I would say, first of all, there is language in subsection F that operates similarly to the word last in the PSL statute, namely the indefinite term any term of imprisonment imposed. And that's precisely what Judge Masano held in his opinion, which was that that word and that part of subsection F functions similarly to the word last. But beyond that, beyond the similarity of
doesn't,
how those...
Doesn't any plain reading or any mean any sentence imposed on that one particular conviction? In other words, it could be 10 years, it could be 30 years. Isn't that what any refers to, that conviction, not any conviction, any other conviction?
I think it just, yes.
Isn't that clear that applies to just this one conviction?
No, I don't think it applies to this one conviction. I think it just refers to any term of imprisonment, which is precisely what it says. But beyond...
Imposed.
Imposed.
For this conviction.
It doesn't say for this conviction. It just
doesn't have to.
Well, I would submit that it has to be specific. I mean, part and parcel to our argument is that these words are broad and unqualified.
No, well, when you look at the sentence and you look at the disjunctive or, has not committed an offense within 15 years following conviction, and then when it says or release from a correctional facility for any term of imprisonment, the sentence is suggesting that the person in the first part of the disjunctive may get a probationary sentence. The person may not go to prison. So, following conviction.
Correct.
Probation or release from a correctional facility. And then it has whichever is later. Okay? Whichever is later.
Right. And so you're right. If a person is sentenced to probation, as HD was here, the operative date would be conviction. But since that word is completely unqualified, it could mean the conviction that triggered Megan's Law in the first place, or a subsequent conviction. But to answer Your Honor's question, Chief Justice Ravner, to the extent that you disagree that the word any functions similarly to the word last, we would argue that the canon of reading these two statutes, which were passed together in the same collection of laws, on the same day, frankly, that served the same underlying purpose, should be read in pari materia. And it doesn't mean that each and every term and phrase in those two statutes must be read together, but they have to be read together to further the underlying purpose of the statute.
Isn't it quite the opposite? They have two statutes. They each impose very different types of, in the one case, punitive aspects of it, PSL, and the other, the remedial aspect of it, and they use different language. Isn't that telling right there? Because they easily could have said, let's just duplicate the language.
But because they serve the same identical underlying legislative purpose,
right,
they have to be read together, at least when it comes to the release mechanism. Because otherwise, there would be inconsistent rulings when it comes to release.
But do statutes have to be reading statutes together to see how they fit into the same legislative objective? I absolutely agree as part of statutory interpretation. Reading them together to mean the same thing, even though the legislature's chosen different language, is not, I would respectfully suggest, part of the inquiry.
I would agree with the premise of your question, Your Honor. I would just say that if you don't read them together on this point alone, on this issue alone, the release mechanism, then when they would not be serving the same underlying purpose. It would be inconsistent, which is what the appellate division held.
So why is it not consistent for the legislature to say we're going to allow the restart on PSL, which imposes a lot of different imposes on a lot of different aspects of the registrant's life, versus the registry, in which case there is one chance to get off this thing, and that's a 15-year period of no conviction.
So here's why. And this kind of leads into the state's argument that because PSL is penal and Megan's Law is remedial, we can have this dichotomy in the release valve, okay? PSL is, the effects of it are no doubt penal, but the underlying purpose is identical to Megan's Law. And that's not my pet theory. That's what this court has said time again. Mm-hmm. For example, In State versus Perez, this court said CSL, quote, is designed to protect the public from recidivism by sex offenders. Then in INRI CA, an early Megan's Law case, this court said Megan's Law is, quote, designed to protect the public from recidivism by sex offenders. So it's a very shallow kind of reading or answer of this to say, well, PSL is punitive and Megan's Law is remedial. That may be the case in terms of their effects, but they have an identical legislative purpose. And that's why both of these statutes, the PSL and the Megan's Law statutes, the release valves, despite maybe using some differing language, they have to be read together in pari materia to at least carry out that same underlying legislative purpose. Otherwise, we're left with the situation is that which befell HD here, which is that the trial judge declared that he was no longer a risk to recidivate, and you could be, and therefore was released from CSL, yet kept him bound and tethered to Megan's Law for the rest of his life, despite the Megan's Law statute serving, again, as I read, an identical legislative purpose.
So the legislature decides that with respect to Megan's Law, with the public notification and protection of the public exclusively being the purpose there, we will give a registrant one 15-year period in which to get out from under. Otherwise, we're going with what the original formulation was, which is a lifetime registration requirement. Why does that not meet the purpose, which everyone agrees, of both aspects of Megan's Law, both Megan's Law and PSL, which is protection of the public?
Well, I guess because it wouldn't protect the public. So in HD's case, he has been declared to no longer be a danger to the public. That declaration has been made. So keeping him bound to Megan's Law serves no remedial purpose.
Well,
it's also
that's
the
case with anybody who's had that form. So you're really attacking Megan's Law on a very basic level, which is to say it has no remedial purpose.
No, I'm not saying that. This is not a full frontal attack on Doe. No one is suggesting the legislature can't have a sex offender registry. We're just simply saying that this very narrow aspect of it has to be interpreted to further that underlying purpose. Otherwise, you have this inconsistent result between CSL release and Megan's Law removal, when in fact this court has said they serve the same underlying purposes.
You know, the legislature passes enactments that don't follow the laws of perfect logic. I mean, what you're trying to do is superimpose that. But the registration law is much different from PSL. Mm-hmm. PSL, as a condition, you can have house arrest, bar for a person from engaging in social media. There are all sorts of restrictions. And plus, CSL requires the commission of a crime, not an offense. There are marked differences between CSL, now PSL, and the registration law. So I know that you're trying to draw parallelisms so that there'll be logic to it, but sometimes laws are passed. We may not think that they're wise, or they should have been drawn this way, but that's just what it is.
Right. It's more than just logic or this being illogical. It goes back to what I've been saying, which is that it doesn't further the purpose of the statute. Now, keep in mind what Doe held. So let's not forget, it took this court 111 pages to explain why exactly this thing we call Megan's Law can constitutionally exist. So it took the court painstaking detail, very exacting measures to explain why it can exist, which is precisely and only that it was remedial. So now the state's coming here 25 years later, and they're saying HD, he's no longer a risk. We've actually conceded to that. But keep him bound to the registry anyway.
They're arguing this is what the statute means. At least one of the attorneys on the other side is saying, you know, there could be applied challenges on a constitutional level. You could possibly win. But he's saying the words as they're written in the statute mean but one thing.
The words as written in the statute do not mean that. It is the state, not the registrants, who are coming here asking your honors to insert a word into the statute that is simply not there. The statute, the word conviction is broad and unqualified. It doesn't allude to the sex offense and only the sex offense that triggered Megan's Law. They're asking for you to insert words into the statute. We are not. We are saying that at the very least the statute's ambiguous, in which case we can turn to canons or maxims of statutory construction, namely the idea that these statutes have to be read in pari materia, as I've been discussing. But also there's another absurd result that kind of flows from the state's interpretation, which is this idea that so long as a registrant remains completely offense-free for that first 15 years, he can commit an offense in year 16 or 17 and still apply for deregistration. So consider these two hypotheticals. Hypothetical one, case in Warren County, Belvedere, New Jersey. A 14-year-old child is placed onto the Megan's Law Registry. Within 6 months of that placement, he steals a box of Legos from a big box store in Phillipsburg, New Jersey. State's position is that that person can never get off Megan's Law for the rest of his natural born life, whether he go another 15 years, 30 years, 45 years, whatever, from the Lego offense. Case number two, client in Mercer County, goes the first 15 years without committing an offense, but then commits a CSL offense in year 15 and a half before applying for deregistration. Their position there is that person's fine. He or she, he can apply for deregistration and release from CSL. So even if we don't think that, forgetting about how unfair that is for the person in example A, that serves no policy whatsoever. Because what the state would be doing there is being attributing more weight to a non-sexual offense that happened decades before the release application than one that occurred on the heels of that application.
Mr. Duddy, can I ask you a practical question? And you're knowledgeable in this area because I know you've been doing it for a long time. The state's plain language argument, at least the AG's, is being made contextually focused on that F is geared from the conviction that caused the person to be obligated to register. Okay, that's the conviction that is tied to the registration requirement. And they point to subsection A to support that as well. And I find that argument a strong one. Now, if you look at C goes into greater detail about how to apply the registration requirement to a number of categories of people. Because we know when Megan's Law was passed, it was being applied retroactively to people whose convictions long predated the coming into effect of Megan's Law. It involved people, as I said before, who were walking out on the streets, had long come out of prison, were released, or people who were just about to come out. And when I look at C, four. Do you have it in front of you?
I do not, Your Honor, but I feel confident I could answer Your Honor's question.
I think you know where I'm going. It's talking about when is the registration requirement triggered for somebody whose conviction was long past in time, Megan's Law comes into effect, when must they register? Because it's obviously not the date of conviction or release from prison. And four says it's you have 120 days to register from the date of this legislation. From your knowledge and experience of working with registrants, how did the 15-year look-back period get applied for people who were in that kind of a category?
So
did it fulfill the argument that the state is making? Did the 15 years run back to the timing of the conviction that caused them to have a registration requirement? Or was it calculated in some other way?
Are you referring to the class of registrants, Your Honor, who were found to be repetitive and compulsive?
No,
and therefore
I'm looking at C4. A person required to register on the basis of a conviction prior to the effective date, who was not confined or under supervision on the effective date of this act, shall register within 120 days of the effective date of this act. And then proceeds to say where you register. So if the state's contextual argument is correct, and the 15 years runs from one conviction and one conviction only, under B4, it should be 15 years back, should go back to the date of that conviction and whenever that 15-year period would end. That's the time period the person should have had to be offense-free, if the state's argument has some traction here.
Well, I don't
what can you help me with?
So I can tell you two things. I can say that The preamble to subsection F that says a person required to register, and this is part of Your Honor's question, part of the point made by the Attorney General's office. All that's doing is just capturing who this statute applies to. I don't see how that
assume for the sake of my question that I'm accepting the state's argument. Conviction means the conviction back in time that triggered the obligation to register.
Right.
Okay. It could be 1 year before Megan's Law, could be 5 years before Megan's Law, could be earlier in time. Who knows? How does the 15 years work?
So in that scenario, that registrant could apply for deregistration from 15 years after the conviction that required them to register under C4. However, since the word conviction in F is completely unqualified, in fact, there's not even an article in front of it like there is in C4, which uses the word A, okay? Because it's broad and unqualified, they could go 15 years from a subsequent conviction. And I would say, Your Honor,
In this scenario, when does the 15-year clock begin?
Under C4, it begins when the person,
From
the date of the conviction that required registration.
So just to follow up on that.
So it's the one conviction. It's that conviction.
In C4?
Person required to register.
Yeah.
Well, it would have to be. So it would have to be in C4. But I'm not sure. I don't see how C4 informs our interpretation.
I'm testing the state's argument as to what conviction means in F. They're arguing conviction can mean only one conviction. It's the conviction that led to the registration requirement. That's why I'm asking you this question.
Yes, that is their argument. And to the extent they're relying on C4 to support that argument, I would say that at best, that just means that the word conviction, which is unqualified in F, is ambiguous. And if it's ambiguous, we get to some of the results that we've been discussing today.
Thank you.
But getting back to my hypothetical here, and this relates to avoiding an absurd result, not the constitutionality of this, but in my scenario, the state has conceded that the person who commits a crime in year 15 and a half is allowed to deregister. And as I said, let's just forget about how unfair that is to the 14-year-old from Belvedere. That serves no policy. And I understand we're not here to create policy. We're not here to make the illogical more logical. But we have to figure out what the policymakers wanted to do. What would they want to do with that?
Is the example as extreme as you're suggesting? Aren't the cases going to get picked up under the last clause? Not likely to pose a threat?
Well, first of all, those are real cases, by the way. Those two hypotheticals. But no. The person in example B, Your Honor, may not be released from the registry on his first application because of how close in time that CSL violation was. But in some years, yes, he will get off the registry, absolutely. Whereas the person in scenario A will be forever barred from relief. Your Honors, you have the power in this case to choose between two interpretations. And the reason you have the power is because, at best, the statute is ambiguous. It doesn't have any qualifiers in front of it or after it to tie the word conviction to the underlying sex offense conviction. At best, C4, Your Honor, gives some support to the state's argument, okay, but it still doesn't answer the question. You'd still be forced with inserting something into the statute that's not there.
But there is a plain language interpretation in either direction, we don't have the power to do anything other than to state what the what we conclude the legislature meant.
That's correct.
So we can't create there's no ambiguity. We can't create one simply to have a choice between two alternative
interpretations. That
is correct.
And I would submit that the plain language inures to the registrant's benefit because there is no qualifier there. But at worst, the lack of any qualifier means it's ambiguous.
What really makes it difficult for you is your so-called in pari materia argument, because if we look to the CSL statute, we know that the legislature knew how to say since the last conviction. They know how to say it. The same legislature, statutes are passed on the same day, and that's absent from the registration statute. Are we to ignore that?
There are other words in both of these statutes that are completely different that operate in the same exact way, and no one's disputing that. So for example, in subsection F, it says within 15 years following. PSL says for 15 years since. The within and following operate the same way as the for and since. The argument, as Judge Masano said, is that there can be slight differences here, even though many of these slight differences operate the same way, but they both have to be interpreted to serve the underlying purpose of the statute. Otherwise, you're left with this irrational dichotomy whereby someone's being declared no longer a risk and released from CSL, but tethered to Megan's Law forever. And otherwise, you're left with the situation in which someone can apply for deregistration under their rubric in year 16. And at first, that application may not be granted, but it will in time. It will. When someone is convicted of a very minor offense, smoking in public, something like that, that'll be granted right away. And by the same token, Your Honors, if a reviewing court believes that an offense committed 16 years ago, so the clock would have restarted after year one, if that offense is somehow indicative of that person's risk present day, that judge can consider that and reject the application under the second prong of the test. And so this goes back to my comment, really my last comment, which is you have the power to choose between two reasonable interpretations, because at the very least the statute's ambiguous. And to harmonize this case with CK, which will be eviscerated if you don't, frankly, and to avoid these two unreasonable interpretations, and to avoid the upset of the administration of justice here with respect to everyone who's already been released, we would ask you to choose the registrant's interpretation. That is the more reasonable interpretation.
Thank you, Mr. DeBrasse.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Duddy, excuse me, Mr. DeBrasse.
May it please the court. So I'd like to return to the phrase any term of imprisonment imposed, because I don't think we're ready to give that one up, and here's why.
I'm sorry, I missed the phrase that you're...
Any term of imprisonment
any
imposed.
Any term of imprisonment, okay. Thank you.
I acknowledge that it's possible to read that as referring specifically to the sex offense. However, that phrase is not in PSL. So PSL says, for 15 years since the last conviction or release from incarceration, whereas subsection F is within 15 years following conviction or release from a correctional facility for any term of imprisonment imposed. So I understand the canon of interpretation where the word appears in one provision and not the other, that it's to be given some effect. I don't think that's the only or conclusive canon of interpretation, but I acknowledge that that is a lot of what we're talking about here. But if you, why would that any term of imprisonment imposed not be in the PSL statute? Unless it has a similar broadening effect as the word last. So if you look at the structure of both provisions, they have a preposition followed by two objects. In subsection F, it's following, and then there are two objects or object phrases, conviction or release from a correctional facility for any term of imprisonment imposed. And in PSL, similarly, there are two objects. Since is the preposition, the last conviction or release from incarceration. And so the broadening language in subsection F is appearing on the tail, on the second object phrase, whereas the broadening language in PSL is appearing before the word conviction.
Why shouldn't we read this simply to mean the 15 years has to have a starting point, and it has to have a starting point based upon an offense, and one of two things happens following the conviction of an offense. One conviction and then a non-custodial term of some kind, or time served, or a term of imprisonment imposed. Obviously, you're not going to start the time running in terms of being offense-free when the person's already in prison. So all they're saying here, why is this not logical? All they're saying here is 15 years starts on one of two dates, either conviction or, if there is a term of imprisonment, the end of that term of imprisonment.
I think that's one way to read it, but I think that's not the only way to read it. I think clearly the reason...
Let me just understand, you're saying that conviction and term of imprisonment could refer to two entirely different offenses?
No. I'm saying that the preposition has two objects which capture when the 15-year clock is going to start. And in subsection F, it's possible to read the second phrase as being referring to any release, basically. So release for any term of imprisonment imposed could literally mean any release.
Let me just understand. Are you saying that conviction and any term of imprisonment imposed could refer to two entirely different offenses? Conviction for one, and then a later offense and a term of imprisonment imposed and the end of that term?
I think that the phrase likely is referring to the same thing, although not one thing. In other words, we know when, assuming that the person is convicted and required to register and notified at sentencing, so we're talking about someone after Megan's Law has been passed, right? That is when the clock starts. There's no doubt about that at conviction. But the question is, does that word conviction, is it possible for it to have multiple reference? And I think the answer is yes, because there's no language in subsection F that precludes it from referring to the subsequent conviction. So,
I don't understand that. Could you go over that again?
Can I ask you, let me see if this is part of your argument in response to Justice Patterson's question. Within 15 years following conviction from the Megan's Law offense, or 15 years from release for any offense? No?
Yes, that's a possible reading. I think also conviction can refer to the second conviction, because if the question is, has a person been offense-free within 15 years following conviction or release, just the plain language of that, that's true for J.M. It's been 15 years following conviction or release. It's only when you start interpreting conviction to have only one referent.
Everything, but even if you look at every section before F, even look at E, it's talking about the sexual offense conviction that gets you on registration. All of those lead up to that. So then we arrive at F, and suddenly, without any reference to other convictions, you're saying, oh, that language is general language. It's not referring to the specific conviction that gets you on the registration list. It has to depart from everything that has preceded it.
Okay, so I think first...
Are you following me?
I am following it, okay. Your Honor, although I would say that, offense... That we know now because of AD that offense refers to any offense under the criminal code. Why can't conviction refer to any conviction? Just because the provision is talking about someone who committed sex offense doesn't mean every
it
word.
Could. And this is where you said anything's possible. Is that our reference point for statutory interpretation in this case?
Your Honor, I think we're trying to get to ambiguity here. Because okay. I think if we're getting to ambiguity, then respectfully,
you have a,
I think
then
that we have lots of very good policy and
yeah, then you have a good constitutional avoidance argument.
Yes. And so it's important to note that phrase in the beginning of subsection F, a person required to register under this act, that phrase only modifies the person who is allowed to make application and the obligation to be terminated. It doesn't limit the word conviction any more than it limits the word offense. And so, and again, I note that any term of imprisonment is a broad and unqualified phrase, which could refer to to literally what it says. And the legislature could have easily inserted words into this provision to make it clear that conviction was only could only refer to the sex offense. It could have said the conviction. It could have said conviction for the offense that required registration. No,
if they were here, they would probably say, could we have made it any plainer? In the CSL, we said since the last conviction. We omitted the language in 7.2 that we had in 6.4.
But then,
isn't that clear enough?
Well, I don't know, because then there's language in subsection F that's not in 6.4 either. So I think that the reason, the canon of reading statutes in peri materia is particularly appropriate when there is a doubtful meaning. And I think that both subsections have language that could be functionally equivalent. And when you read them together, you get the basic harmony of if a person has been offense-free for 15 years and not likely to pose a threat to the safety of others, there's a possibility of relief. There's also some other language which is suggestive in both subsection F and PSL. Take the phrase has not, for instance. Has not
in subsection F we are?
Yeah, correct. Right, so in other words, has not committed an offense within 15 years. The phrase has not in the English language refers to an opportunity that may still be seized, whereas the phrase did not refers to an opportunity that is gone forever. So one mundane example of this would be she did not win the race. The race is over. There's no opportunity to win. She has not won the race. The race is still ongoing, and there is a possibility of...
But respectfully, does that make any sense at all? Because the person's only going to make the application, and this is operative when they make the application after the 15 years has elapsed. So it's a done deal. If they do this in year four, they're wasting their time and their lawyer's time. They've got to wait the 15 years from some time, and this entire thing is set up to be viewed. Did not, you know, what you say did not would mean has got to be the situation because the time period is done.
Well, I think it indicates that the condition is one that could possibly be fulfilled in the future.
Sometimes did not and has not really don't have any different meaning. She did not win the 2019 New York City Marathon. She has not won the 2019 New York City Marathon.
But she's still running.
Yeah, she's still running.
But it can make a difference.
And how does that help your argument?
Because it is signaling that it is a condition of qualifying for this relief that could be fulfilled in the future. I think there are a lot of little textual clues. And as I said before, we're just trying to get to ambiguity here. I want to return for a moment to the C4. I don't have the statute in front of me, unfortunately, but basically the idea is there were some registrants who had to register 120 days after the effective date of Megan's Law to provide some kind of notice period because they weren't going to be told at sentencing that they had to register since it was being retroactively applied to them. So what that means is that under our interpretation, that person may have had to register for less than 15 years. In fact, that person may have registered and then the next day applied for termination. Because if they were convicted in, I don't know if I trust my math here, but 1979 and were sentenced to the end, but were found to be repetitive and compulsive, okay? They have gone 15 years from the date of conviction without committing an offense and are eligible to apply to be relieved from Megan's Law, but they don't have to register for 15 years. So I think the significance of that to this textual interpretation is that it breaks apart the seeming or the state's argued close correspondence between the registration, 15 years of registration, 15 years from the date of registration and the application to be terminated for
Megan's Law. I'm sorry to belabor this. I just want to completely make sure I understand this. Somebody was convicted 15 years, before, 16 years before Megan's Law was enacted.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. They have gone 15 years offense free since the end of, since their conviction or the end of their term of incarceration, whatever, whichever is later. Just assume that.
Right.
Megan's Law goes into effect. What did that individual have to do, if anything?
They have to register, and then they may apply. They immediately may apply under subsection F to be relieved from the obligation.
Okay. So their 15 years counted from the time of their conviction for the original Megan's Law. Wasn't then a Megan's Law offense, but the offense that qualified them for Megan's Law.
Correct. But they were not required to register for 15 years. So I think it's a little bit of an oversimplification to say this whole thing is geared towards 15 years of registration.
No, it's 15 years of proving that you can be offense free.
From conviction.
Or
release.
Sentence imposed for that crime.
Well, Your Honor, I understand how any term of imprisonment imposed can be understood to refer solely to that crime, but I don't think it necessarily has to be read that way. For any term of imprisonment imposed, one interpretation of that phrase is that it just means any term of imprisonment. So,
doesn't that speak to the length of imprisonment for that particular offense?
Yes.
Not some other offense that you're in sent for 14 years. Under your interpretation, you could be out a year later. You don't need 15 years because if you've already been convicted and you get out around the time of the trial, then you could just say, okay, I'm 15 years free from that offense way back there.
If the person was convicted at least 15 years prior to the passage of Megan's Law,
then he wouldn't
but
have
I
to,
think the state...
He wouldn't have to wait for shit, whatever.
Right, because they have 15 years offense free from the day of conviction. I don't know that there's really a lot of dispute about that. I'm not sure that there's been any case law on it. But the point is that it's not always 15 years of registration.
I think we understand your argument. Is there anything else you want to present?
Your Honor, so I do believe that we preserved the argument of constitutional avoidance below. I think if you look at the transcript, certainly in my transcript, I was quoting language from a Judge Kilgallen who had talked about the need to...
Constitutional avoidance is a means of statutory interpretation. I wouldn't suggest that you haven't preserved that. That's different from having raised an outright constitutional challenge to the statute. It's two different things.
I agree. But in order to resolve whether the court needs to engage in constitutional avoidance, I think the court has to consider whether the state's interpretation may raise a serious constitutional question.
When there's an ambiguity. That's when constitutional, when there is some ambiguity, maybe however small, that's when constitutional avoidance is triggered.
I agree. Unless the court has any other questions, I think that will conclude my presentation.
Thank you. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court, I'd like to do two things. I'd like to talk, I have some comments on subsection F and some comments generally about the role of courts vis-a-vis legislatures. Let me start there. Justice Albin, I think you're right. If the court determines that the plain language of the statute is subject to only one interpretation, then the plain language applies, and we don't get further than that. But for example, when Justice Fernandez-Vina was reading the statute, he was adding words to it from what was in the plain language. He was saying, when we're talking about the conviction, we mean the sex crimes conviction. It's not there. So if the legislature wanted to solve this problem, they could have been more careful in their drafting.
It's the only interpretation. I wasn't adding words, but I read the statute directly, as I said. And that's the only thing that can be read
position. You think it's the only interpretation, but I believe that the petitioners here, or the registrants, have proposed another one, which is, and I want to be clear, they're not saying that you ignore crimes within that 15-year period. They're saying you restart the clock. So the idea that it's whichever one is later, conviction or release from imprisonment, applies with equal force, which is to say, in 2000 you commit the crime of conviction, the sex crime. In 2003 you commit a, you steal a candy bar and you go to jail for a year, then it's not until 2004 that your 15-year clock begins. So it is equally logical to measure those two things under their interpretation. But let me step back and say a couple things. Number one, Justice Lavecchia, you pointed out that in Doe v. Poritz, the court said, listen, this was a hastily drafted statute in response to, frankly, a horrific event and an emergency response. We can't, on the one hand, say, and therefore, even though the research that they claimed supported this turned out to be debunked, we ignore, because that's all rational basis requires, and then at the same time say, but every minute decision on linguistics was an intentional one on the part of the legislature. We have to, if we're talking about a hastily drafted statute, then we can't say, well, if they meant it to be the exact same thing as PSL, it would have been the exact same language. That's not the way legislative drafting works. I promise you that the six advocates here and the seven justices there have certainly spent more time with the statute than any member of the legislature did at the time.
That's not exactly the point that I was making about.
Oh, I know it wasn't. I was
hastily crafted legislation.
No, but my point is that the hastily crafted legislation, what's sauce for the goose is also sauce for the gander. It both gives the legislature the opportunity to not need to cite specific studies for everything they want, but it also should, in interpreting the statute, give us some sense that perhaps there wasn't the greatest degree of precision.
Do you agree CSL was an entirely differently structured statute?
Of course.
That was allowing a whole new punitive penalty that could be imposed for sentences going forward. It was not a look back.
I agree completely.
So Megan's Law needed to deal with an entirely different set of facts.
Again, I agree completely.
Okay. It helps to explain the different choice of language, does it not?
It is one possible explanation, and the other is that it was a hastily drafted statute.
Oh.
Justice Albin, you point out that subsection F is the first time that the reference point to the conviction would be something other than the triggering offense, if registrant's interpretation is correct. Conviction in subsection F, they argue, deals with any conviction. You're saying, no, it must be the triggering one, because in A through E, that's what it dealt with. But two things. First of all, F is the first. A through E talk about how you get on the registry. F is the first time you talk about getting off. So it's a different portion of the statute. But take, for example, the word offense. Everywhere else in the statute, offense has the word sex in front of it to indicate we're talking about a sex offense. But this court has interpreted the word offense without that modifier to mean sex offense. So again, what's sauce for the goose must be sauce for the gander. I want to go back to
Isn't that true of the other point? Because sex offense and offense are two different terms, and you look at them differently. And we're talking about the word conviction that appears consistently throughout the statute with the same term, conviction. Not last conviction, not subsequent conviction, conviction.
The argument advanced by the Office of the Public Defender in AD was that because every time the statute used sex offense, they meant sex offense. Every time that they meant to talk about
remember
sex offense, it was modified.
Yeah, I remember the case. Yes, but you know, obviously those are two different terms, as we've concluded. All I'm saying is we're not dealing here with a change in terminology within the same statute as there was we were there. We're dealing with the same term, conviction, that appears over and over again.
Right, but so it gets back to my primary point, which is that F deals with getting off of the registry, whereas A through E deal with getting on. So it would make sense that it would deal with something else.
But remember, the beginning of 7.2 is a person required to register under this act.
Yeah.
That is for a sex offense. We know that. You're not registering for stealing a candy bar.
I understand that. That actually gets me to my next
and
point.
Then, and then if you read that in, a person required to register for the commission of a sex offense may make application to the Superior Court of the state to terminate the obligation under proof, then read the rest of it, and
it makes your
argument more difficult, no?
No, I think we know we're talking about people convicted of a predicate sex offense. There's no doubt about that. The question is the offense free period one or re-triggered by subsequent convictions? I want to get to where we started. The first words my friend Mr. DeCote started with, was he explained that the statute, that the subsection F has two provisions, but only one is relevant. I think that's wrong. I think that's wrong because the second provision, if you think that there's only one interpretation, we lose. This is over. If we're getting to what did the legislature intend, we have to think about that second clause, which is a court measuring whether or not the person is likely to pose a threat. And if the court decides that the person isn't likely to pose a threat, then Ms. Anderson's claim, which I don't think is supported by the evidence, but this claim that, yes, there's research out there that says that you evaded a fare or stole a candy bar the year after, 15 years, or forever, for life, 30 years later, you're still a risk. They wouldn't need the 15-year bar because the fact that you had committed that subsequent offense would prevent the judge from making the second finding that you're unlikely to pose a risk. But in this case, we know the judge did make the second finding, at least in Mr. Duddy's case, and presumably will in the other case. So when we're talking about this remedial statute, the purpose of Megan's Law is to protect the public from dangerous sex offenders. But the state has conceded that that's not these registrants. They are not dangerous by the state's own concession. So if you have a system that imposes a burden on people that the state admits are not dangerous, it at a minimum violates substantive due process and may well be converted straight to punishment. So again, there's not a constitutional challenge before this court now. But if you think that there's a plausible other interpretation, to interpret the statute in the way the state suggests is to unmoor Megan's Law from its remedial purpose. The remedial purpose is to protect against dangerous sex offenders, not anyone. And to the idea that we should interpret the statute as broadly as possible because the legislature wanted to register everyone, that's not true. The legislature wanted to protect against dangerous sex offenders, and as when we dilute it by adding in that serial candy thief or fare evader or whomever else, we are making it harder for the public to identify that subset of people who are dangerous offenders. So the public policy weighs in favor, again, if you think it's susceptible to multiple interpretations, in favor of the registration, the interpretation set forth by the registrants.
Questions, anyone?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider.
Thank you.
Mr. DeCote, brief rebuttal.
Very brief, Your Honor. Three very brief points. First, and I won't throw any counties under the bus, but if there's any county prosecutor's offices that are still not taking the same position, that's in direct contradiction with advice we've received from the Attorney General, consistent with the position in this case. I don't know that we haven't conceded anything in this case. Our position as to HD has always been that he doesn't meet the first prong, and so we don't get to the second prong. If you look at the transcript, the first transcript in HD, the appellate division brief, the petition for certification, it's always been that we don't get to that second step. Based on the judge's finding as to CSL and that's terminated, that's probably the way it would end, but we've never conceded that. And third, just to your hypothetical, Justice LaVecchia, I think that is correct, that after, and I think we're all in agreement here, that if a person is convicted in 1979, of an offense that would make them eligible to register, if they came in after registering and said, we haven't done anything in 15 years, and they can make that showing, they wouldn't be entitled to come off. Conviction means what we say it does, and that's the conviction that triggers Megan's Law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Galemba, did you want to offer a rebuttal?
Thank
you, and thank you to all the attorneys. Very fine arguments this afternoon. We'll take the matter under advisement. We're going to take a brief recess and come back for the disciplinary matter.